Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy Nickpour. Today, we take you to the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations at Point Lookout in Northport. We have two speakers, Jack David and Melanie Kirkpatrick. They're both senior fellows at the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C. Our speakers address the topic, North Korea, Perils and Unhappy Options, taking a look at the country since the meeting between Kim Jong-un and President Donald Trump this June. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and this program will be archived on our website, mainpublic.org. Just click on radio to hear this program again at your convenience, and you can access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. You can also find it as a podcast. Introducing our speakers today is George Look, president of the Midcoast Forum.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the 413th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, both to our members and guests who are here today, and to our public radio audiences coming to us, reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from Point Lookout in Northport, Maine. I'm George Look, president of the Forum. The Forum was founded in 1983 to promote study and discussion of the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies. We are now in our 35th year of monthly meetings featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of U.S. foreign policy. Details about past and upcoming forum programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. For our meeting today, we're very pleased to have two speakers, Mr. Jack David and Ms. Melanie Kirkpatrick, who will address security and human rights issues related to North Korea with two presentations that they have jointly titled North Korea, Perils and Unhappy Options. The first speaker today will be Mr. Jack David. Jack David is a senior fellow in national security and a trustee at the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C., and he's also a trustee of the Committee for Human Rights on North Korea. Mr. David served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense from 2004 to 2006, where he was responsible for developing plans and policies related to controlling weapons of mass destruction, including issues involving North Korea and Iran. He is a recipient of the Secretary of Defense Outstanding Public Service Award. Prior to that, he served in the George W. Bush administration in other national security positions. Mr. Davis practiced law in New York City from 1967 to 1995. His legal practice focused on representing foreign and domestic clients in predominantly civil litigation involving corporate matters, contracts, acquisitions, and business reorganizations. He holds a bachelor's degree from Rutgers University and a law degree from Columbia University. Today's second speaker will be Ms. Melanie Kirkpatrick. Melanie Kirkpatrick is a writer, journalist, and a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. She contributes reviews and commentary to various publications, including to the Wall Street Journal, where she worked for 30 years. At the Wall Street Journal, Ms. Kirkpatrick was a longtime member of the editorial board. She began her journal career as a copy editor in Hong Kong, rising to become the op-ed editor and then deputy editor of the Wall Street Journal's opinion pages. Ms. Kirkpatrick received a bachelor's degree from Princeton University and a master's degree from the University of Toronto. She is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, a trustee emerita of Princeton in Asia, a member of the advisory board of the Human Freedom Program of the George W. Bush Institute, a member of the Trollope Society, and a director of the America for Bulgaria Foundation. Among her other publications, Ms. Kirkpatrick is author of Escape from North Korea, The Untold Story of Asia's Underground Railroad. World Magazine named Escape from North Korea the best book of 2013. Jack and Melanie, welcome to the Midcoast Forum. And I understand, Jack, you're going to speak first, so I would turn the floor to you.
I think everybody knows that the principal thing on the mind of those making policy and the president having to do with North Korea, the principal thing, but not the only thing, is the possibility of an attack on American forces in Asia or on Los Angeles or Boston or Washington, D.C. or any other American city using nuclear weapons, as well as the possibility that North Korea will follow its traditional activity of distributing weapons of mass destruction to terrorists and others. But the U.S. interests in Asia are much more expansive than that and much more complicated than that, as complicated as that is. Asia, East Asia, is of vital economic importance to the U.S. and is a dangerous and volatile area of the world. 1/3 of U.S. trade is with Pacific Rim countries. 5 of the top 15 U.S. trading partners are from East Asia, or Asia. China, Japan, South Korea, India, Taiwan. This means jobs here in the U.S. For example, in 2015, more than 11.5 million jobs in the U.S. were attributable to U.S. exports. That's a lot of people have their means of living dependent upon trade with countries in this region. Approximately 80% of world trade by volume is done by sea, and 60% passes through Asia. 1/3 of global shipping passes through the South China Sea. China, Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan are all extremely reliant on this shipping. If war broke out, the shipping of protagonists would be targets. Through bilateral and multilateral treaties, the U.S. has defense and security agreements which recognize that aggression against numerous Asian countries or the U.S. implicates the interests of both and is a call to military action. These countries include Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, the Philippines, and Singapore, which is very far south but yet is crucial to our military and defense and security relationships in East Asia. These security arrangements have had an important role in preserving essentially the peace of the last 60, 70 years in Asia and have been a principal part of the architecture that has allowed our friends in Asia and us to prosper financially and to improve our standard of living. North Korea is a peril to the safety of its neighbors and the region. The June 12 Singapore summit didn't do anything to change the situation that existed before, although it did give evidence for the American people and the world that the President Trump and his administration has gone the last mile toward resolving the North Korean nuclear threat by non-military means. North Korea has grown more dangerous over the past 25 years, and the danger from North Korea grows every day. The Kim family regime had a goal and has a goal. That's to unify the Korean Peninsula under its rule. That was the goal of Kim Jong-un's grandfather, the goal of his father, and his goal as well. It will not be relinquished, in my view. North Korea has the fourth largest army in the world. It has built huge tunnels under the no man's land, which is euphemistically called the demilitarized zone. It's got an array of powerful artillery, some with weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons, in the hills overlooking Seoul. So it's in a position with that artillery and its other means, including its nuclear weapons, to threaten the South while it waits for an opportunity to achieve its objective one way or another. North Korea has developed and deployed and probably deployed nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles to threaten and intimidate the United States to back away from supporting South Korea in defending itself from the North. North Korea has conducted 6 nuclear weapons tests since 2006 by the explosion of fissile material. Various institutions and experts have reported that the North has produced sufficient weapons-grade material to produce 20 to 60 nuclear warheads, including a version of a warhead that's miniaturized, lightweight and compact, suitable for delivering by ballistic missile. North Korea has developed 10 to 14 variants of missiles, both single and multi-stage. It's demonstrated liquid fuel and solid propellant missiles in recorded tests. It conducted at least 15 missile tests in 2017 and 60 since Kim Jong-un took power in 2011. The North Korean Hwasong-12 missile is a medium-range liquid fuel missile having a range between 2,300 and 3,700 miles. It can target Japan. It can target our troops in Japan. It can target Okinawa and other places. The North Korean Hwasong-14 missile is a two-stage long-range missile having a range of more than 6,000 miles. It was first tested on July 4th, 2017, and again on July 28th, 2017. The July 28 test suggested that that missile can reach just about any part of the continental United States. And the November 28, 2017 North Korean test of the Hwasong-15 missile confirmed that it can do so, although there are technical difficulties to be overcome by North Korea, which they're working assiduously on. North Korea continues to aggressively develop its missile program, and there's every reason to believe that it's determined to succeed in overcoming the technical obstacles to its delivering a long-range nuclear missile to our territory, and that it will overcome the impediments. It has not stepped back at all from these objectives and these activities since the June 12th summit. All the evidence is that the Singapore summit on June 12 has not resulted in North Korea abandoning its intention to conquer the South, its intention to further develop nuclear weapons capability. It's furthering the goals that it's held for so long through so many generations. Satellite images from the past few weeks indicate that North Korea is not stepping back from, but it's expanding the missile production facility and constructing a new building at one of its plutonium-producing reactors. That's since June 12th. Its submarine-based missile launch capability is continuing to be developed, at least at the port of Sinpo. After the summit, North Korea's propaganda department, headed by Kim Jong-un's sister, instructed the cadres not to mention the word denuclearization when speaking of the summit to North Korean people. North Korea has taken no important steps that we would consider important for denuclearization, much less disarmament. Indeed, in official statements after Secretary Pompeo's trip to Pyongyang early in July, North Korea said that Secretary Pompeo's insistence for complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization of North Korea was, quote, very concerning, unquote. Since then, in the last week, the North Korean foreign minister told the foreign minister of Iran in Tehran, as reported in newspapers, that North Korea would not give up its nuclear knowledge, given the continuing hostile attitude of the United States. The hostile attitude of the United States to which he's referring was at least in part the unwillingness for the U.S. to relieve the sanctions on North Korea until considerable progress toward denuclearization, as most of us in this room would think of denuclearization, complete, verifiable, and irreversible, was taking place. The North Korean Workers' Party issued a statement through a North Korean newspaper a few days ago, I don't know whether it was Thursday or Friday, saying that the continuation of the sanctions by the United States was very troublesome to North Korea, and North Korea could easily destabilize the entire peninsula. That's it. So I think the prospects are bleak for a peaceful resolution of the problem that North Korea poses to the United States and to all of East Asia, to our prosperity, to the lives of the people who it tyrannizes, who my wife Melanie is going to tell you more about in a minute or so. It looks like the problem will only be resolved with military action of some sort, spawned by some event that we don't know now, or some event that is initiated by some country, North Korea, China, ourselves, whatever. Sorry, I can't give you happy news.
Well, I'm afraid I can't give you happy news either. I've been following North Korea since the early 1980s, when I was the op-ed editor of the Asian edition of the Wall Street Journal. And a submission crossed my desk about North Korea. It was written by an Italian journalist who was living in what we then called Peking, and he was working for a German newspaper. He got a rare invitation to go to Pyongyang for a week, and he wrote an article which he submitted to me about his experiences. And I was really blown away by what I read in that little article about the worship of the Kim family by the ordinary people of North Korea. And I remember to this day the final, the concluding line of his article. He wrote, "I got back to Peking and I kissed the ground, happy to be back in a free country." Now, China, as we know, was not free, is not free today, and it was a lot less free in the early 1980s. But this brings me to what I want to talk about today. One thing I've observed over the years, and especially during the years I was writing and then talking about my book, Escape from North Korea, one thing I've observed is that while everybody understands that North Korea is a bad place, and that the dictators there don't have any regard for human rights, very few people have a true understanding of just how bad it really is. So I thought I'd spend my time talking about what ordinary life is like in North Korea. And this is directly connected to the issues Jack has been talking about, because it demonstrates that North Korea is not a normal nation, and Kim Jong-un is not a dictator with whom the United States can negotiate in the ordinary manner. North Korea is a slave state. The United Nations Commission of a couple of years ago described what it called the unspeakable atrocities of North Korea. And this UN Commission concluded that the gravity, scale, and nature of North Korea's human rights violations reveal a state that has no parallel in the contemporary world. This is the same United Nations, by the way, that usually goes out of its way not to criticize a member nation. For 70 years now, the Kim family has controlled every aspect of North Koreans' lives, including, most cruelly of all, whether they eat or whether they starve. Religion is banned, there is no rule of law, and the Kim family dictators are worshipped as gods. Every home is required to display and take care of portraits of the dictators, the grandfather and father of Kim Jong-un. And failing to maintain these photographs, that is, not dust them properly, is a serious offense. As you may have seen in photographs of North Korean officials, every adult wears badges over his heart, showing pictures of Kim Il-sung, the grandfather, and Kim Jong-il, the father. A North Korean refugee whom I interviewed in his new home in Rochester, New York, pointed to a photograph of his family on the wall of his living room, and he said to me, "This is the difference between North Korea and the United States. Here in the United States, I can put a picture of my family on the wall. In North Korea, I am required to put pictures of the Kim dictators on the wall." For this refugee, that family portrait of his symbolized liberation. So let me give five quick specific examples of what life is like for an ordinary North Korean. First, apartheid. The regime assigns every North Korean to one of 57 different castes. These castes are related to the perceived loyalty of his family to the regime. And they are very much connected to his family's background. This caste, or songbun, as it's called in Korean, determines his social status, which in turn determines where he is allowed to live, whether he can go to university, what kind of job he can have, even whom he will marry. It is impossible to change your caste. The regime believes that children are tainted by the blood of their ancestors. If, say, one of your uncles fought on the side of the South during the Korean War, you and your children will automatically be members of a low caste. The second fact of North Korea that I'll mention is hunger. UNICEF says that one-third of the children under the age of 5 show signs of stunted growth, a result of malnutrition. Just on Friday, the International Red Cross predicted that there's going to be a severe food crisis in North Korea this year as a result of the severe hot weather there that is ruining the harvests. And this, if it happens, will be yet another pressure on the regime, and we don't know how it will respond. You won't see any of these stunted children in Pyongyang because that's a closed city of about 1 million people, and it's reserved for the privileged elites. Ordinary people can't even visit Pyongyang without a permit. The regime uses food as a political tool and makes sure that it goes first to political elites and to the military. Many international aid agencies refuse to operate in North Korea because they can't control who gets help. The third aspect of North Korean ordinary life that I'll mention is political crimes. There are numerous political crimes, among them speaking ill of the dictator, possessing a Bible, or leaving the country without permission. The Kim regime practices collective punishment. 3 generations of a family may be punished for the crime of one member. If you were sent to prison for a political crime, chances are your parents and your children will go with you. Similarly, diplomats who are sent abroad are sometimes required to leave one or more of their children back in North Korea as a kind of hostage. They know that if they defect, the price of their freedom will be the life of one of their children. The fourth fact of life in North Korea is the paucity of information about the outside world. The regime strictly controls access to information. It is forbidden to make international phone calls or to listen to foreign radio broadcasts or to watch a DVD that has been smuggled into the country from China or South Korea. Most incredibly of all, at least to me, is that the internet is available to only about 1,000 users out of a population of 25 million people. Also incredibly, radios are permanently fixed to the government-run radio station. If you buy a radio, you are required to register it with the police, who will check to make sure that you haven't tampered with it to allow you to listen to foreign radio broadcasts. That said, in the past decade, more and more North Koreans are defying the regime and listening to these foreign radio broadcasts, such as Radio Free Asia, or watching DVDs from South Korea or elsewhere. This is a very positive development, as it weakens the legitimacy of the regime, both in the act of defying the regime, but also in the information it provides to North Koreans about life outside their borders. So the realization dawns on them that, maybe North Korea is not paradise on earth, as the regime has told them. I hope I'm going to have the opportunity to say more about this in the Q&A session, because I think it's the most, maybe the only, positive development that I can see in the country. And the last aspect of life in North Korea that I'll mention is the prison camps. Someone has said that North Korea has as many words for prison as Eskimos have for the word snow. There are local detention centers, there are labor re-education camps, there are political prison camps. In every case, though, prisoners suffer under horrible circumstances, little food, hard labor, torture, public executions. The stories I've heard from the North Koreans I've interviewed are gut-wrenching. At least 1 million North Koreans have perished in the political prison camps, and the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea in Washington estimates that 120,000 men, women, and children, yes, children, are incarcerated there currently. There is no doubt about their existence. We can actually see the prison camps from space. All of this information about life in North Korea is relatively new to us. We certainly didn't know it in 1981 or 1982 when I published that op-ed on North Korea in the Asian Wall Street Journal. And as recently as 15 or 20 years ago, the country was so tightly sealed that the outside world had very little idea about what was going on there. Then North Koreans began to escape, mostly through China, and it is thanks to the testimonies of these escapees that we now know the truth about life in North Korea. The apartheid system, the political prisons, the worship of the Kim family, and much, much more. These escapees are performing an important function. They are educating North Koreans back home about life in the world outside their borders. As I wrote about in my book, the escapees have sparked a kind of information invasion, finding ways to get information back into the country, either something as simple as hiring a courier to physically deliver a letter or a verbal message to somebody back in North Korea, or through high-tech means. There are organizations now run by North Koreans who have escaped and are living in South Korea, who, for example, send in flash drives, you know, these small little flash drives that they manage to, in one case, they just put them on street corners. And people will come along and take one. And they'll, just because they're interested, they may not have access to the internet, but more and more people have computers, so they can plug them into their computer and maybe see a soap opera from South Korea, which is devastating to the North Koreans I've interviewed who have seen these soap operas, because they depict a prosperous, free society where, you know, in the soap opera, a person, let's say they're sitting around the family dining table and the food that is plentiful on the table. Well, then they get out and go into their own car. Just about no North Korean has been in a private car because private cars don't exist there. What I'm saying is that the escapees are empowering the North Korean people with information. And the hope is that this will help to drive change there from the bottom up. Given the brutality of the regime's crackdown on any glimmer of dissent, a popular uprising doesn't seem to be in the cards anytime soon. But then again, who would have predicted the overthrow of Ceausescu in Romania or Gaddafi in Libya? So let me close by saying that in my view, the human rights crisis is unlikely to be solved without regime change. The same holds true for the nuclear and missile crisis. I agree with Jack that the Kim regime is highly unlikely to give up its nuclear weapons. Possibly, I could imagine a scenario where perhaps China puts enough pressure on it and offers an alternative scenario that they would do so, but I think it's highly unlikely. I also believe that a nuclear North Korea is an existential threat to the United States, one with which we cannot live. It would be folly to accept North Korea as a nuclear nation, as some are suggesting. A regime that treats its people as slaves cannot be trusted to use its nuclear weapons responsibly. Thank you.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. We've just heard from Jack David and Melanie Kirkpatrick discussing the dangers of the North Korean regime at the Midcoast Forum in Northport. The conversation will continue with questions from the audience.
I want to thank Jack and Melanie very much for giving us a lot to think about and a lot to ask questions about. I'm going to take the prerogative of the moderator to ask the first question. Jack, we focus on nuclear, as you said, but the North Koreans also have very active chemical and biological weapons programs, and Seoul is within artillery range of the North Koreans, and they have artillery shells that have chemical and or biological capability. Why are we ignoring that in all this? Why are we focusing so much on nuclear and not on these others?
Well, I think that the reason that we're focusing on nuclear is that the devastation that could be wrought by the delivery of a nuclear weapon by missile is so great. It's multiple times of the danger that the chemical or biological weapons that they have could do in any single instance. Also, I don't think that we're ignoring the chemical weapons that they have in the hills, and that can be delivered by artillery. I don't think that we're ignoring that. What they can do depends upon which pieces of artillery they're using. They have artillery of different capabilities. They have old stuff that isn't very good that can't even reach Seoul. Most of it can reach the outskirts of Seoul, but not reach Seoul itself. Not only that, but we know the locations of the artillery, and once the artillery is used, especially if the best artillery is used, it'll be trackable by the responding artillery that's in place from the South Koreans and from the United States. So they could be destroyed quickly. That, of course, is information which is, the details of that is classified information, but I can guarantee it does exist, and it is maintained as currently as possible to maintain it. It is part of the war plans that we have. By the way, war plans doesn't mean that you're ready to go to war. War plans are developed by the military for every situation where there might be war. What happens? It's planning for what happens. And the war plans are changed every few years as technology and as resources and as the political situation changes as well. But I have no doubt that we are prepared to respond, and the South Koreans are prepared to respond to the military.
Thank you very much. Lots and lots of questions, I'll tell you. Melanie, here's one for you. Your bio mentions a North Korean underground railroad in your book that is to assist the defectors. How does this work? Is there like the Underground Railroad in the U.S. during the Civil War, or is it?
It's very similar to the Underground Railroad in the U.S. During the Civil War. It's a network of secret routes and safe houses across China. And let me first say, you may think that if a North Korean wants to leave his country, he could just go south to South Korea, where all North Koreans are welcome. And the answer is he can't, because of the demilitarized zone, which, despite his name, is the most heavily fortified border in the world. So he has to go through China, or at least most go through China. And from China, then he has to travel all the way across China to Southeast Asia, where he goes to a neighboring country and then goes to a South Korean facility, asks for asylum, or to a U.S. facility. About 200 have come to the United States, but the most go to South Korea. Now, in China's policy, which is very inhumane, and it has been criticized by the UN Commission for Refugees, China's policy is to track down, arrest, and repatriate any North Korea it finds in China. Because it's a crime to leave North Korea without permission, those people who are repatriated face very harsh punishment once they get home. I've interviewed many of them, because then they often escape a second time or a third time and eventually reach safety in another country. The people who help, there are two kind of categories, very quickly, of people who help them along the Underground Railroad. One is brokers. That is people who are in it for the money. If a North Korean, or now a North Korean who's escaped and made some money in Seoul and is trying to get a child out, a broker does it for the money and will help the North Koreans get out of China. But then there are the humanitarians, most of whom are Christians and most are from South Korea and the United States. And they operate surreptitiously in China, where they provide support and help these people get out of North Korea. And I interviewed many of the rescuers, and it was fascinating. And I write about this in detail in my book. But for example, I'll just give you one quick example. The women, and a majority of the escapees are women, the women, one of the first things they're taught to prepare them for the journey on the Underground Railroad is how to use makeup. And they also give them Chinese clothes to make them look more fashionable, because their haircuts, their lack of makeup, their clothes identify them immediately as North Koreans.
Is there any point at which China would step in and control or stop Kim's North Korea's nuclear program? Kindly explain U.S. Pacific Command's role in providing security and how that interact and how we interact with the Chinese on that. Do you think China supports North Korea's aggression? We've got a lot of them on China and North Korea.
The only way China is going to support the denuclearization of North Korea is if China is convinced that the United States will act unilaterally to its disadvantage. Chinese policy is in conflict with U.S. policy in many ways. North Korea can be used to help China so long as North Korea doesn't go out of control of China. For example, China is illegally asserting sovereignty, dominion, over the South China Sea. It's in conflict with, has border conflicts about the sea, about the pieces of property in the sea, islands and the like, with the Philippines, with Vietnam, with various countries. Just a few days ago, a Chinese air controller warned U.S. military planes, which happened to have CNN reporters on them, flying over the South China Sea to get out of the South China Sea on the claim it was Chinese sovereignty there. The planes did not. The planes said, this is international airspace, and we're allowed to be there. That's an illustration of a conflict. North Korea can be a danger to the U.S. The U.S. doesn't have resources to do everything in every place in the world. And so North Korea is very useful to China in that respect. But if North Korea gets out of control, potentially foments an instability that China doesn't want, is a different story. Plus, China is not unilateral. Even what you read about Xi Jinping, who has taken control of China to a large extent, it's not really quite entirely true, because there is conflict within the Chinese Communist Party and among political leadership of China, especially came out in the last month or two. There's a chance that Chinese policy could shift this way or that way. I believe that so long as the Chinese leadership, and by that I mean Xi Jinping plus everybody else, believes that the U.S. may take military action to deal with this threat to Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., Boston, and the like, they'll be more inclined to work together with us to bring about regime change, which I think the regime change, one way or another, I agree with Melanie, is the only solution to the humanitarian problem and is the only solution to the security problem from nuclear weapons and the artillery.
Well, one thing I'd say about China is that on the human rights issues, it very much fears an invasion, hundreds of thousands of North Koreans across the border. And it would create a refugee crisis that would be very destabilizing for Northeast China. So that's one concern it has. Another concern it has is North Korea's nuclear weapons and the concern that there could be an explosion or an accident of some sort and the radiation would come over the border into China. Finally, I'll point out that North Korea and China, for all the publicity about how China supposedly has influence on North Korea, you know, North Korea really hates China. And so Kim Jong-un had his uncle murdered by anti-aircraft guns a couple of years ago. Why? Because he was making outreaches to China. So, you know, that the extent of China's influence over North Korea is also ambiguous.
Let me ask one that's directed here at Melanie, and it's a very simple question. What's the position and treatment of women in North Korea? Is any different than men?
Well, North Korea, I could go on, maybe I should write a whole book about this, but there's a chapter in my book called Brides for Sale, and it talks a little bit about how women are treated in North Korea. Of course, they have, on paper, equal rights, but they are very much second-class citizens there. More interesting to me, because I interviewed a lot of these brides for sale, is that the majority of people who leave, who escape from North, ordinary people who escape from North Korea, are women, and they flee to China, as I said. About 75 or 80% of the North Koreans who are now safely living in South Korea are women. One of the reasons for that is that the men in North Korea are more likely, if they go missing, to be noticed by the authorities. A woman can escape, especially a young woman, can escape across the border more easily, and the authorities won't be as concerned about her absence because she's not so important. The authorities in North Korea. And another reason that so many women go to North Korea, to China, pardon me, is that there's a market for women in China. There is a market as brides for young Chinese men. There is a big surplus of young men in China because of the one-child policy, which encouraged couples who could only have one child to abort if the fetus was a girl. So especially in the Northeast, which borders North Korea, a young man can place an order for a bride from North Korea. A Chinese broker will go in there, persuade a woman to come to China, usually not telling her that she's going to be sold as a bride, but that's one thing that happens. Another thing that happens is that women from North Korea are so desperate to get some money that they will go to China and work in the sex trade industry. There's a lot of internet pornography that uses North Korean women. So that's a partial answer.
Jack, you obviously hit a nerve when you said that you thought the only thing that might resolve it is some type of military action or might lead to some military action. There are a number of questions. I think the one that was most succinct is this one. Under what circumstances would you favor a U.S. military attack on North Korea? How would you prevent collateral damage to South Korea?
You know, those of us in this room, including me, don't have access to the information which would be ingredients to the decision to take military action. Most important, what kind of military action to take. That decision would be influenced by how effective would it be in eliminating the nuclear threat. What resources do we have to bring about this damage or that damage? What would the collateral damage be of that? What have we done to help prepare the North Korean people for what we are considering doing and how we would do it? What would be the next step? What arrangements have we made with allies? What discussions have we had with allies about this potential course of action? What discussions have we had with adversaries, China, Russia, about this? What kind of support would we get from the South Korean government, which is populated in their Blue House, which is the White House for them? It's called the Blue House in South Korea. The Blue House, the president of the Blue House and its chief of staff, and at least 20 of the people who are there are in South Korea, called Taliban 386. The name comes from their days as students when they were vociferously supportive of North Korea. And in the days since, when they were elevated to positions in government and now the President Moon and its chief of staff and the like, they have done things over these years to be supportive of North Korea. So all of those things would be taken into consideration in making the decision. But the overriding issue for us is that the people of Los Angeles, the people of Boston, people of New York, people of Chicago, our soldiers in Okinawa are at risk of nuclear attack. And we can't live with that. The situation has to change. And I haven't mentioned another kind of attack, which isn't spoken about very much. Do any of you in the room know about EMP? The missile test that North Korea launched in December of 2012 took a southerly route. The satellite it launched, the package it launched, went around the Earth at least two or three times before falling. Well, the Russians, since 1964, had a plan to explode a nuclear weapon that, if they decided to use this, like a war plan, to explode a nuclear weapon 300 miles above the center of the United States, not on the land in Boston or San Francisco or Los Angeles, but 300 miles above. Why? It produces an electromagnetic pulse which then fries all of the transistors of every piece of electronic equipment that's in this country that isn't hardened. And there are very few that are hardened outside of the military. Even in the government, there isn't hardened equipment. The television sets in the Pentagon, the computers in the Pentagon, just like your computers at home and your television sets at home, they're not hardened. So they would be fried, useless forever.
A congressional commission a few years ago estimated that if there was an EMP attack over the United States, 100 million Americans would die.
They wouldn't die from the pulse. They would die from the lack of medicine, from the disease, lack of food. The disruption to our society was estimated by this commission to be so great that 100 million people would die within a year. So we can't live with this, and we can't make a decision in our op-eds and our editorials and so forth about, you know, when's the best time to do this. Because it depends on all the kinds of things that I talked about a little bit just a couple of minutes ago. There are a lot of ingredients to making that decision. And you're actually going to be making, when you make the decision to use military equipment, you're making the best of lousy decisions, the best of the worst decisions. And that's why I really applaud even though I don't think that the President Trump's effort to persuade Kim Jong-un on June 12th to give up the family business of taking over the South and by hook or by crook and making his country to be as successful economically as the South and making his place in history on the basis of not doing what his family has been aiming to do for all these years, but for making it a prosperous country, a successful country like South Korea. I applaud it, even though I don't think there's any chance of it, or there's almost no chance of it succeeding.
I'll direct this at Melanie this time. On whether there's an active or viable opposition or resistance movement inside North Korea, and related is there a growing middle class? Is there a group of people who, you know, ultimately will rise up and say enough is enough?
Yeah, well, no and no. As I think in the way that we think of it. But what is happening is what Vaclav Havel talked about. I think he called it little acts of defiance or something. There, for the past decade or more, many North Koreans are defying the government, the regime, in small ways. And that's creating a mindset that I think is could potentially grow to some kind of full-blown dissent or uprising. But we haven't seen that yet, and unfortunately, we've wasted a good decade by not. I think we could have done a whole lot more to encourage that. At the same time, because of the sanctions and because of the poverty in North Korea, there's been a lot of illicit entrepreneurial activity, especially along the Chinese border. So people have a lot of North Korean people have understood that if they're going to survive, literally survive, they have to make it on their own. And so they're trying to figure out ways of maybe setting up a little farm on their own. And in the past, the regime would crack down on this kind of activity. But Kim Jong-un has kind of not cracked down, or at least let some of it take place, because I think he realizes that if hundreds of thousands of people started to die of famine, that might help to spark some kind of rebellion.
I think that the chance of a rebellion of the sort that we would think of as a rebellion is nil to none. But there are 2,000 people, or roughly 2,000 people, on whom Kim Jong-un depends to rule the country. If those people, because of the sanctions that we're imposing, because of the economic circumstances, don't get their fancy food, and they don't get their Mercedes, and they don't get their Hennessy cognac, and they don't get the things that they've been getting to help him tyrannize, and his father and grandfather before him to tyrannize the country, maybe they could do something. Melanie told you about the uncle who was close to China, who was killed by our artillery gun, as an example, and many others who were in his circle, who were also had relationships with China, were killed at around the same time. It's an illustration of how the country might have changed had those people not been killed. They might have done some kind of a deal with China to get rid of this regime.
Well, that's a very good point. And one other quick thing I'd add is that unlike in a few years ago, there are more defectors leaving North Korea. That is, people who actually have high government positions. And there have been a handful of them in the past couple of years who have defected. And that's very good news, because it suggests that, first of all, we learn, get some information from them, but also it is a model to the people, these 2,000 that Jack mentioned, that maybe if you can defect, a good life will come to you as well.
I wanted to end with a question that we must have a dozen different people asking in different ways. Has Trump's diplomacy helped or hurt the situation, or hasn't it affected it either way? And was President Trump duped? Did Kim win? Was he duped? Did Kim get what he wanted to out of it?
Well, yeah, you can say President Trump was duped if you want to, but the fact of the matter is that you'd be criticizing him for making an effort to avoid a calamitous situation where you're using military power. I think, as I wrote in June, and as I said even before when they were talking about it, I didn't think the summit was going to take place because there wasn't any chance that it was going to succeed. But you can't fault him for trying to do something. And we didn't lose anything by it. Maybe Kim certainly helped himself by the summit politically in the world, but he's also helped himself by his meetings with Xi Jinping of China, and his forays into Russia and the like. He's been adroit diplomatically to improve his political position internationally. But I don't think that the Trump administration policy so far has had any impact to change the situation. And that's my view.
I would say on human rights, his record is mixed. On one hand, he has met publicly with North Koreans who've escaped. Most prominently, at the end of his State of the Union address, you may have seen the North Korean escapee lift his crutch in the air when he was in the First Lady's box and he was introduced by Trump. So that's good. It helps the American people understand what the reality of life is in North Korea. But then he hasn't appointed, for example, there is an ambassadorship in the State Department for human rights in North Korea, and he hasn't bothered to appoint anybody to that. So that's on the negative side. It made me sick to see Trump and Kim shaking hands in front of a bank of their flags, to shake hands with this murderous person. But I agree with Jack that at least showed that he was making an effort. I would prefer it he would not have tweeted, made some of his tweets about how the North Korean crisis is solved. But and I think he will. I think he actually will figure out, if he hasn't already, that it's far from solved.
I thank you very much. That was very, very good.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today we heard from Jack David and Melanie Kirkpatrick, senior fellows at the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C. They recently joined the Midcoast Forum in Northport to discuss the state of North Korean denuclearization and human rights. If you missed part of the program or you want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click radio to find this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock and Talk Talk. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Roddy Nickpour. Thanks for joining us.